KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump is feeling the heat over affordability issues. Will it threaten his political agenda? We'll have the latest. The holiday season isn't far off, and tariffs are pushing up the price of one very important item, the artificial Christmas tree. We talk to a manufacturer about the challenges facing his industry and also get a little bit of advice.
Look for a tree that you love, and if you find it, it's on some kind of sale, I would buy it.
Plus, a new documentary tells the story of how a neighbor's harassment turned deadly. It's Sunday, November 16th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Connecting with nature is part of the Anishinaabe way of life, and on the Red Lake Nation, a charter school is seeking to help foster that connection, incorporating Ojibwe language and tradition with the seasons. Red Lake's only charter school recently partnered with the Nature Conservancy for the purchase of a new pontoon to take environmental learning out of the classroom. The nonprofit's tribal relations coordinator, John Littlewolf, is at the Boy Fort Band with ties to the Cass Lake area. He says the goals of the Nature Conservancy align well with the priorities of the Red Lake Nation.
Peatlands, water quality, science and monitoring, these are our specialties at the Nature Conservancy. And so again, it is a natural fit with the Red Lake Nation on so many fronts. And this opportunity is such an exciting one for me because these students are going to be able to experience something that I wish I would have had this opportunity going to school to be able to get the classroom out onto the water.
During the inaugural pontoon outing on Fuller's Lake Wednesday, a handful of charter school families braved the cool November weather for boat rides and hot chocolate. Fuller's Lake is tiny compared to the nearby Lower Red Lake, but features interesting islands and beneath the water's surface, some underwater caves. The charter school's executive director, Nate Taylor, says he was reminiscing about special memories.
So we grew up playing all through this area. Like I said, I almost drowned in this lake. We were kids, we swam all the time here. And it just was, it's like one of those epiphany moments, like where you're just in the moment and you're really happy. And I started singing a song because I was remembering him.
Taylor says the song he was gently singing above the roar of the pontoon motor was one he wrote for his younger brother, who died young from juvenile diabetes. Fuller's Lake is just a couple miles away from the charter school and will be one of the many water bodies within the Red Lake Nation the students will explore with their new equipment.
We wanted to know about, you know, almost every single tree that's out there, every single plant that's out there, every single, because we did know at one point, every fish that's out there. So this boat will give us the opportunity to get kids out on the water and, you know, get in to learn about, you know, Mother Nature from a perspective that you don't really get to if you don't have a boat.
Ndaji Nitawiging is the name of the Ojibwe Language Intensive Charter School for grades K through 8. Kindergartners and first graders experience more Ojibwe immersion than older students, but the entire school's curriculum is closely tied with language and seasonal traditions.
There's types of seasons when we gather wild rice, type season we gather blueberries, strawberries, maple syrup, and just reconnecting. I think it's our moral responsibility to do that and to get our kids to do that, because our people always thought seven generations down the line. Our ancestors thought of us, and that's why I feel like Red Lake is so strong.
Taylor says the school, initially chartered 4 years ago, stemmed from a decade of dreams that began with a pre-K program called the Wasabik Ojibwe Immersion School.
This school kind of evolved from that because we were teaching kids the language at 3 and 4 years old, but you need to keep on them because at that school it was only 4 hours for 4 days.
Revitalizing language and education is key, Taylor says. The U.S. and Canada's prior policies of residential boarding school systems frequently took Indigenous students out of their communities where they were punished for speaking Indigenous languages or for practicing traditional customs, in addition to suffering other abuses.
My wife and I had some firsthand experience. We went to Haskell Indian Nations, and it's a college that's built on an old boarding school. So you can see like the evidence of what happened. Mm-hmm. You've seen child handcuffs and different things, a historical center there of, you know, of what happened. There was railroad tracks, and they would ship us in like cattle. And, and a little bit of the history of what happened to our people and why we don't speak our language.
Native American students continued to face several challenges within the traditional American education system after the boarding school era. And Ndaji Nitawaging's director of academics, Rochelle Johnson, says the school takes a more holistic approach to education.
We develop a strong sense of belonging, a strong sense of who they are as young Native people in the community, and we're really community-based. You know, and practice local culture with, you know, and teach that.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXC News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
In addition, from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The federal government is gearing up for its first full week of work following the end of the shutdown. But the president is facing pressure on a number of issues, one of them being affordability. Traveling on Air Force One, he explained his decision to lift tariffs on a number of items.
We just had a little bit of a rollback on some foods, like coffee, as an example. Where the prices of coffee were a little bit high, now they'll be on the low side in a very short period of time.
So where does this leave the president's signature economic policy? Joining me now to discuss that and much more is NPR senior political correspondent Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Aisha.
So President Trump's appeared, maybe a little bit more defensive in the last few days. What's behind that?
What's behind it is his dropping poll numbers and his party's poor performance in the off-year elections. And he is trying to address this affordability issue. He's throwing some of his tariffs overboard. He announced on Friday he's scrapping U.S. tariffs on beef and coffee, tomatoes, some fruit. And this is a big backpedal for him. He's not stopping at tariffs. He is floating the idea of sending Americans rebate checks of $2,000 to buy health care. He's floated the idea of a 50-year mortgage. He's started an investigation of meatpacking plants. Recently, he signed a deal with drug companies to lower the price of obesity drugs. So this is a very big turnaround for a president who until recently was saying polls that showed voters' concerns about the cost of living were fake. He said the economy has been great. It's booming. Inflation was down. Now he seems to be acknowledging that prices are up and that his own tariffs are making these prices higher. This is a big reversal.
Well, a lot of these economic issues kind of feel a little bit like deja vu, right?
Well, they're very similar to the problem that President Biden faced. Affordability was one of the big reasons Democrats lost in 2024. Biden kept on saying, just like Trump was, inflation is down, the economy is good. But that's not how voters felt. They don't care about the rate of inflation. Voters care about prices, whether they're higher or lower, and mostly they're higher. And voters who are struggling with affordability feel like politicians who tell them the economy is great are insulting them. And it certainly didn't work for Biden. And it's a big challenge for Trump because with affordability, you can't just post your way or tweet your way out of it. You actually have to deliver. And that's hard.
Now, the government has reopened and many federal workers are breathing a sigh of relief. But politically, how do you think the shutdown played out for the two parties?
Well, one thing it did for Democrats was unite them in anger and frustration at Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate who couldn't keep his party together. Democrats are angry at the 8 Democratic senators who broke ranks and voted with Republicans to end the shutdown. They feel it was too soon, particularly after their triumph in the off your elections. But the funding bill only goes till the end of January, so we'll get to do this again in a couple of months. And the other thing Democrats feel is a silver lining for them is they did get a vote on health care next month. Republican senators will get the choice to join with Democrats and extend the Affordable Care Obamacare tax credit subsidies or not. Democrats feel they are on the right side politically of this issue, and they think they're going to put some pressure on Republicans.
And Jeffrey Epstein is the scandal that, you know, just refuses to go away. House Speaker Mike Johnson said he put forward a bill this week that would compel the Department of Justice to release the complete Jeffrey Epstein files. What does all of this mean for the president?
Well, it means that this is an issue that's not going away, although Trump would very much like it to. The vote in the House was forced by what's called a discharge position. Four Republicans joined Democrats to circumvent the leadership and bring this bill to the floor, even though Speaker Johnson didn't want it there. This week, the House Oversight Committee released more than 20,000 documents related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, including some emails from Epstein mentioning President Trump. But none of those emails were more incriminating than showing that Trump might have known more about Epstein than he has said he did. Trump is now trying to turn the tables. He's ordered Attorney General Pam Bondi to investigate Jeffrey Epstein's ties to Democrats, including former President Bill Clinton.
Well, and finally, Mara, just an official told NPR the table is being set for possible military action in Venezuela. What more do we know?
What we know from NPR's reporting is that the world's largest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, will arrive in the Northern Caribbean today. And it remains unclear if President Trump will actually use military force against Venezuela. He told reporters on Air Force One, quote, "I sort of made up my mind," unquote, about whether to launch an attack. But he also said, "I can't tell you what I've decided." So that's something to watch.
That's NPR's senior national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Thank you so much, Mara.
You're welcome.
President Trump hosts Saudi Arabia's crown prince this week. There will be a formal White House dinner for Mohammed bin Salman. U.S. intelligence linked MBS, as he's also known, to the killing of a Saudi Washington Post columnist in 2018. That's just one example human rights critics of the kingdom point to. When he last met Trump in May, the crown prince promised $600 billion worth of Saudi investments. Yasmin Farouk is the project director for the Gulf and Arabian Peninsula at International Crisis Group. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, how would you describe the current state of U.S.-Saudi relations?
Well, I think both sides are banking a lot on the personal rapport between the two leaders. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and President Trump are two people who put business and economic and trade relations first, and the economic growth, of course, in the case of the United States, as top priority in the bilateral relationship. And in that sense, they understand each other, they speak the same language, and so they get along, and it allows them to drive the conversation later into politics. They also speak the same language when it comes to conflicts and regional security in the Middle East, in the sense that they want to stop wars. They want the region to move from insecurity to prosperity, even if they differ on the path to take in order to reach that regional stability and prosperity.
What are the main points of tension between the two countries? What are the challenges?
Saudi Arabia was very worried by the U.S. support to Israel over the past 2 years. Although the three countries, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. agreed on the end goals of, you know, defeating the proxies of Iran in the region, Saudi Arabia didn't necessarily think that such a high-intensity conflict in Gaza should have been supported by the U.S. Saudi Arabia thinks that in addition to the use of force, there must be negotiations, there must be diplomacy. But they differ, for example, on who's going to govern Gaza in the transition period. They differ on the time frame of Israeli occupation of Gaza. You have other differences, for example, on dealing with Iran, where Saudi Arabia is worried that the United States is not going to keep Israel in check and that there will be a new round of war in the region and Saudi Arabia could become a target. I would say that the Trump administration administration has shown that it is willing and capable to use force. Saudi Arabia would like it to use diplomacy with the same energy and with the same heavy-handed, if I might say.
Talk to me about the diplomacy, because obviously the U.S. helped Israel and Saudi Arabia come very close to normalizing relations. Those plans were thwarted by the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 7, 2023. Could normalizing be back on the table now with Trump back in office?
Saudi Arabia kept normalization on the table, but kept it as long as it will be linked to a pathway to a Palestinian state. And that's because Saudi Arabia believes that there needs to be a solution once and for all. It was Israel first that said that it refuses any kind of concession that would lead to a Palestinian state, and that if this is the Saudi condition, then normalization will not happen. And to go back to your questions, the details of that solution are where U.S. and Saudi Arabia may differ. And I am sure that this will be discussed during the Crown Prince's visit.
So one point of contention in the relationship between the two countries historically has been over human rights. And that was definitely one of the points of tension with President Biden. How do human rights factor in with President Trump, or do they factor in?
I think President Trump made it very clear when he came to Riyadh that he respects the separation between the domestic and foreign policy realms when it comes to other countries. And him and his envoys have been repeating this, saying, we will not tell countries how to govern their people. So I don't think, or I'm actually pretty sure, that human rights and domestic politics inside Saudi Arabia will not be on the agenda.
That was Yasmin Farouk, Project Director for the Gulf and Arabian Peninsula at International Crisis Group. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the right time to give to KAXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps People Power Radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. And find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region. Heard on The Morning Show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at KAXE.org. You can become a Minnesota Master Naturalist during a 5-day training at Long Lake Conservation Center in Palisade, January 17th through the 21st. Find more information and register at minnesotamasternaturalist.org/courses.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. North Carolina's largest city is now the latest to be targeted by a surge in federal immigration agents. The Homeland Security Department confirmed the surge in Charlotte last night, and agents have been seen making arrests. Charlotte's Democratic mayor says they're causing unnecessary fear. More rain is in the forecast for Southern California, which has already been soaked by an atmospheric river storm. The region remains on alert for the potential for mud and rock slides. And the activist and author Alice Wong has died. A close friend says she died of an infection Friday in a hospital in San Francisco. She was 51. Wong was a champion of people with disabilities. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Now, it may be a little early to talk about Christmas, but I like to be organized, and that means thinking about my tree. According to a survey by the American Christmas Tree Association, more than 80% of households planning to put up a tree this year opt for an artificial one. But those trees, once seen as the cheaper, more convenient option, are getting more expensive as tariffs and higher production costs drive up prices. Mac Harmon is the founder and CEO of Balsam Hill, which manufactures artificial Christmas trees, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Let's just start by comparing prices, and this is important to me because I'm going to be buying a new artificial Christmas tree this year. How much did an artificial Christmas tree cost this time last year versus now? And I'm talking about for the average tree, not some huge, massive thing.
What we've seen this year in the market is that prices have gone up about 10 to 15% looking across the different retailers.
And so help us understand, like, what part of production is most affected by tariffs?
In the Christmas industry, 90% of Christmas decorations have been made in China historically. Because the products are made in Asia, there's really not been any increase in the manufacturing costs. It's just in the tariffs that we pay to the U.S. government to bring those goods into the United States.
Could you move your production here so you wouldn't have that?
We do source some products, not Christmas trees, but other Christmas products in the U.S., and that has been affected as well because our suppliers in the U.S. purchase component parts overseas, and those have been tariffed. So the prices have gone up no matter if we make something here or we make it other places. That said, specific to China, we have been working over the last 5 or 6 years to diversify our supply chain and get outside of China. We've manufactured Christmas trees in Mexico. We've manufactured them in Indonesia and other places in Southeast Asia. But all of those places have been tariffed.
Okay. I know you said that even manufacturing here, you still have to deal with the component costs. Is there something specific about Christmas trees why you wouldn't look to manufacture them in the U.S.?
Yeah, the interesting thing about pre-lit artificial Christmas trees is they've actually never been made in the U.S. And the reason for that is because it's a really painstaking process, and we do it by using zip ties and clips and making sure the bulbs stick upright so they look great. And so back over 30 years ago, when unlit trees were made in the United States, someone had this great idea to pre-light the trees. The American workers, even 30 years ago, were like, no way, I am not doing this. I just think it's very unlikely that something that's almost like basket weaving is a trade that's going to move from a lower wage, lower cost of living country to the United States for the first time.
Some companies have tried to eat the tariff cost while others feel they have no choice but to raise prices. Has Balsam Hill done anything to try to combat raising its prices?
We have done so many things to try and keep the prices as low as possible. And so, unfortunately, we did do a reduction in force. We stopped a bunch of growth projects and reduced our hiring. We froze raises. So there's all sorts of things we did to reduce our expenses. We also negotiated with our suppliers and asked them to shoulder some of the cost of the tariffs. And then the biggest thing we were able to do was we brought in a lot of our product for Christmas 25 before the tariffs took effect, or before higher tariffs took effect. That's not going to be a tool that's available to us for Christmas 2026. But for this year, as soon as President Trump won the election, we shipped as many products as we could between November and January 20th, Inauguration Day, because there was a lot of discussion that there was going to be a day one tariff.
What's your advice for families who want to get the most value out of their artificial Christmas tree this year?
I think the best idea is to look for a tree that you love. And if you find it, it's on some kind of sale, I would buy it. I would not wait, because I think we are going to see a shortage. Most retailers cut back the number of trees across the industry. The American Christmas Tree Association believes that 15% fewer trees were purchased this year by retailers than last year, and demand is generally pretty steady. With 15% fewer trees, I do think we're going to have reduced choice later in the season. I think kind of waiting and seeing if you might get 10% off if you wait 2 weeks, I don't think that's going to work as well this year as it might in a normal year.
That's Mac Harmon, CEO of Balsam Hill. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Federal employees went back to work last week following the end of the government shutdown. But just hours later, one government scientist was told she was being put on leave until further notice. She believes it's retaliation for her criticism of President Trump. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The morning after Congress voted to reopen the government, Jenna Norton returned to work at the National Institutes of Health.
At 7:15 at my normal time.
She had a team meeting, caught up on some emails, and then just after 2, a notice arrived from HR informing her that she was being put on paid leave, not for any disciplinary purpose, the notice said, but Norton strongly believes otherwise. She went on TikTok to explain.
I strongly suspect it is because I have been speaking up in my personal capacity about the harms that I've been witnessing inside the National Institutes of Health.
Norton has been at NIH for more than a decade. She's been deeply alarmed by the funding cuts and the mass firings of staff at the agency this year. In public statements and media interviews, she warned that the Trump administration was politicizing research and canceling studies, putting the health of participants at risk. She spoke to NPR just after the shutdown began.
I feel like I have this front row seat to the destruction of our democracy. You know, we are seeing it in real time with a president who is asking us to do things that are illegal and harmful to the American public.
The Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees NIH, did not respond to NPR's questions about why Norton was placed on leave and instead issued a statement calling her a radical leftist. Now, there are a number of other civil servants who have likewise been sidelined after speaking out. Two government attorneys who enforced fair housing laws got termination notices after raising the alarm about the dismantling of their work. An agriculture department worker is on leave facing termination after warning about disruption to food assistance programs during the shutdown. Speaking on Friday, Jenna Norton says she knew she might face consequences eventually.
I was not totally caught off guard, but at the same time, I did not expect it to happen yesterday.
Now, Norton believes her speech is protected under the First Amendment. She points to a 1968 Supreme Court decision that found public employees can speak on matters of public concern as long as it doesn't disrupt government operations. She also knows federal employees have whistleblower rights. Still, she says she was never under the impression that her rights would be respected, given the tactics the Trump administration has used to shrink the government. But
I also recognized that if you don't assert your rights because you're afraid or because you're demoralized or for whatever reason, then you've already given them up. You've let them be taken away.
Something Jenna Norton says she's determined not to do. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Alice Wong was born with muscular dystrophy. She spent her life advocating for the rights of disabled people.
Disability is so much more than pain, trauma, and tragedy. There's creativity, adaptation, and talent that comes from living in a non-disabled world.
That was Wong speaking with her digital voice after winning the MacArthur Genius Award last year. In 2014, she created the Disability Visibility Project, which chronicles the oral history of hundreds of disabled people.
Storytelling is a powerful form of resistance. It leaves evidence that we were here in a society that devalues, excludes, and eliminates us.
Alice Wong died in California on Friday. She was 51. California is no stranger to extreme weather. This weekend, the state was hit by a huge storm system forcing evacuations. It's these type of weather events and wildfires in particular that are driving up the prices of home insurance. That's especially true in Northern California's Lake County, where many companies are just canceling policies. Now community leaders are working to reduce the risk from wildfires. But as Lauren Summer from NPR's Climate Desk reports, many of the insurance companies aren't taking note.
Penny Sidhu is getting a home makeover, which she feels like she won out of the blue.
I have no words. I'm just like shocked.
But it's not a makeover you'd notice, standing in her front yard in Kelseyville, California, surrounded by rolling hills.
The screens on top of the gutters. So now I have new gutters with screens on them so the debris can't get in.
Sidhu's house has been made over to protect against wildfires. She's part of a new California program to make homes less likely to burn. After evacuating from fires three times in the last 9 years, Sidhu got concerned about overgrown brush between her and her neighbor's house.
You couldn't even see her roof. Like, it was like our houses were connected. There was huge trees and bushes.
She found out she was eligible for the Lake County Home Hardening Program, which uses state and federal funding. Deanna Fernway, the program manager, set up an inspection to look for vulnerabilities, like those bushes.
So if those were to combust, it would catch both of their roofs on fire. And so we removed all of the vegetation.
It's about protecting the house from embers, tiny bits of burning debris carried by the wind far from a wildfire itself.
More than 90% of homes catch on fire due to embers, not direct flame. So that is what we highly focus on.
Fernway's team removed the bark mulch near the walls of Sidhu's house and put in gravel. She'll get a metal gate in her side yard instead of wood.
I would never have been able to afford this. There's just no way I could do it. Especially I'm by myself. There's just no way.
Many of Sidhu's neighbors are in the same boat. The county has a lot of lower-income households. But some have gotten wildfire improvements, too, because the state program is focused on this neighborhood. Wildfire risk goes way down when many homes participate together. Sidhu hopes that insurance companies will notice that.
People are having such a hard time getting insurance on their houses right now. My daughter just bought a house in Crescent City, and it was a nightmare to get insurance.
But there are no guarantees that companies will keep insuring Sidhu and her neighbors.
This insurance crisis is hitting everywhere.
Jessica Pyska is on the Lake County Board of Supervisors. She says in the last decade, about 70% of Lake County has burned. She lost her own home in 2015. And insurance has become a huge problem. Some residents are seeing rates double or are being dropped by their insurance companies.
I know a lot of people that are just going without insurance right now.
Pyska says the county is trying to reduce the wildfire risk with a range of projects. They've improved evacuation routes. They worked with federal and state agencies to reduce flammable vegetation in the forests around them. And there's the home improvement program.
People are trying to do everything that they possibly can to get their rates lower, but it's really not helping much.
Some insurance companies are offering small discounts, 5 or 10%, for homeowners that make their houses safer. But companies don't have to consider the work a whole community does to reduce their risk.
How do we get to the point where the insurers are saying there's a much lower risk here? Community-wide, we'll come back and we'll lower the rates, or maybe not raise the rates quite so much.
That problem comes down to information. Nancy Watkins is a consulting actuary with Milliman, a risk analysis firm.
To really understand if the risk has been reduced, an insurance company would theoretically need information about what my neighbors had done. That's very difficult for an insurance company to know about or to verify.
It's something Watkins is trying to change. She's helping start the Wildland-Urban Interface Data Commons. It would aggregate all the community wildfire projects into a big database, one that insurance companies can use to see where the wildfire risk is getting better. She says there's a lot to figure out about how it will work, like protecting consumer privacy and getting insurance companies on board. But it could help those companies provide discounts where they don't right now.
As long as there's a disconnect between what people and communities do to reduce their risk and what they're experiencing from their insurance companies, if that disconnect persists, there's this bias to do nothing. People think nothing that I do will matter.
Insurance is a key motivation, she says, for incentivizing fire-prone communities to prevent disasters. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. Move Over Red Delicious, Gala Honeycrisp, and Fuji apples have become some of the most popular varieties in the U.S. Honeycrisp, in particular, have achieved apple stardom in produce aisles across the country. But for the farmers who grow these apples, Honeycrisp can be a nightmare.
They're like the mean girl at a dance. It's time to be mean to her.
That's Jeff Thornton, a longtime apple farmer in Washington State. His daughter, Kate Thornton, is also in the family business, but she's better known on TikTok as Apple Girl Kate. Kate Thornton, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
How do you feel about Honeycrisp apples? Do you really like them?
I love them just to eat them right off of the tree. They're some of my favorites. Some of the organic Honeycrisp that we grow are some of the best that I've ever had. But then from the grower perspective, the business perspective, they can absolutely kill you because they just store terribly. And so it doesn't really make sense for our food supply system.
So it's not the growing of the Honeycrisp apples, it's the storing of them that's the issue?
It's both, really, because there's a lot of input costs up front. People really like them because they've got this foamy texture, I would say, because of their cell structure. And they've got thin skin, which people really like, versus the Red Delicious has a thicker skin. But yeah, it does have more fiber. But it makes it tougher for, first of all, picking the fruit bruises easily. We have to clip the stems so they don't puncture each other in the bin. And then for the storage, that cell structure has a lot of issues with calcium deficiencies. And so it develops all these disorders in storage.
Tell me more about the farm that you work on. Like, how long has your family been growing apples?
Well, it's kind of cool that we're doing this. It's been 100 years since we started growing fruit in this valley. My great-grandparents started out with some apples and some cattle. And then when my dad got into it, he's third generation, he kind of had to rebuild the ranch. So he and my mom took it from about 23 acres to now we're over 400 acres. And he started growing pears as well. But one thing about apples is because there's so many varieties, we like to grow as many as possible. We're sitting around 10 different varieties that we grow.
Do you think of apple varieties as having different personalities? Like if Honeycrisp are the mean girl at the dance, like what are the others?
My father and his analogies. I definitely kind of characterize them in my head. I think of the Red Delicious as like the old grandfatherly variety versus we're growing some new ones like Sugar Bee, which is kind of like the sweet, but like very charismatic person. And then we've got Cosmic Crisp, which is a little bit more like, I'd say, spunky. If you like some of the kind of tart aspects, but still like that sweetness, I go Cosmic Crisp. If you like something that's more of a flat sweet, similar to a Fuji, similar to the Honeycrisp, I would say Sugar Bee. Both of those varieties are half Honeycrisp. And then out of, I think, Michigan, you got the Evercrisp. That's also half Fuji, half Honeycrisp. There's a ton of new varieties, and that's why we always encourage people, like, try different varieties. If you're not eating a bunch of apples, we are certain that we have an apple that fits your ideal flavor profile.
Kate Thornton, fourth generation apple farmer at Thornton Farms in Washington State. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. United Way of Bemidji Area's Holiday Gifts for Kids program is now accepting new, unwrapped gifts for those aged newborn through 17. Donations may be dropped at several locations in Bemidji now until December 8th, including the Tourist Information Center. Find more information and registration forms for families at UnitedWayBemidji.org. The Friends of the Grand Rapids Area Library will hold a holiday book boutique Monday, November 24th from 10 to 6 at the library, featuring books of all kinds, plus puzzles and games. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine is working to resume prisoner exchanges with Russia. Zelensky made the announcement in a social media video a day after his national security chief announced progress in negotiations for the release of 1,200 Ukrainians. Protesters took to the streets across Mexico this weekend to denounce rising violence following the killing of a mayor earlier this month. There were clashes with police in Mexico City after protesters tore down fences around the National Palace where President Claudia Sheinbaum lives. And voters in Chile are going to the polls today in the first round of a presidential election in which crime and immigration are among top concerns. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Legacy Box, dedicated to helping customers turn boxes with family videos and photos into memories that can be shared with generations to come. More at legacybox.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I am excellent. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. Will, will you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, it came from Mark Scott of Seattle. I said, think of a famous actress, first and last names. I said, interchange the first and last letters of those names and say the result out loud. You'll get some advice on fermenting milk. What is it? Well, the actress is Drew Barrymore. If you switch those first two letters, first and last names, you find that you should brew dairy more.
This must have been a tough one because there were just under 250 correct entries. And this week's winner is Phil Feller of Durham, North Carolina, my hometown. Congratulations, Phil.
Thank you.
All right. So how did you figure out this week's answer?
I wish that I could say I had a clever insight, but for this week's answer, I just brute forced it and went through a list of actresses until the combination jumped out at me.
Oh, wow. So how long have you been playing the puzzle?
I go back to the postcard days.
Okay, wonderful. But this is your first time winning?
It's my first time winning, but it's not the first time that I've had an answer mentioned on the air. 10 years ago, I submitted an answer. And Will was kind enough to say that it was so clever, it just blew him away.
Well, that's wonderful. So it sounds like you're definitely ready to play this puzzle, but I gotta ask, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
You're definitely ready. Okay, take it away, Will.
All right, Phil and Aisha. Every answer today is a well-known brand name that's also the proper name of something else. For example, if I asked what brand name of an iced tea is also the name of a U.S. state, you would say Arizona. So here's your first one. What brand name of chocolate bar is also the name of a planet?
Mars.
That's right. Brand name of a vacuum cleaner. That's also the name of a U.S. president.
Hoover.
Good job. How about a brand of paper towels? That's also an historical ship.
Bounty.
That's it? A brand of cigarette that's also a state capital?
Marlboro. No, Marlboro.
Nope, state there's capital. No state capital of Marlboro. Think of the capital of Oregon.
Oh, Salem.
Salem, is it? How about a brand of lock that's also a university?
Yale.
That Yale, is it? A brand of potato chips that's part of Massachusetts?
Potato chips, part of Massachusetts.
And it's a part of Massachusetts that juts out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Cape Cod?
Cape Cod, is it? Brand of ice cream bar that's part of Alaska and northern Canada.
Klondike.
That's it. A brand of peanut butter that's also a classic children's book.
Peanut butter and classic children's book. Oh, Aisha, have you got any ideas on this one?
I think this is the one where they never grow up.
That's it.
Oh, Peter Pan, of course.
Peter Pan, is it? A brand of bottled water that's also a South Seas island?
Fiji.
Uh-huh. A car model from Ford that's also a sign of the Zodiac.
Car model from Ford. Taurus.
That's it. And here's your last one. A brand of drink mix that's also a Chinese dynasty.
Chinese dynasty drink mix. Tang.
Tang. Good job.
You did a really wonderful job because a lot of these I could not think of. But you did a wonderful job. How do you feel?
Relieved.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Phil, what member station do you listen to?
I am a sustaining member of WUNC, and I'm also a longtime sustaining member of Minnesota Public Radio.
That's Phil Feller of Durham, North Carolina. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Dave Shukin of San Marino, California. Take the name of a famous person in American politics, six-letter first name and six-letter last name. Hidden in this name, reading from left to right, but not in consecutive letters, is the name of a well-known place that's very dry in four letters. If you remove these letters, the remaining eight letters in order from left to right will name another well-known, very dry place. What politician is this? So again, a famous American politician, 6'6", hidden in this name, reading left to right, not consecutively, in four letters, is a well-known, dry place. Drop those letters, and the remaining letters in order left to right will spell the name of another well-known, dry place. What is it?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. To submit your response, just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, November 20th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shaw. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Have you ever had a package coming that you're really looking forward to, only for it to never arrive? Researchers recently learned more about a cybercrime ring that hijacks shipments in the real world.
It's literally a $35 billion industry. Like, that dwarfs other cybercrime.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, listen by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. On June 2nd, 2023, Ajika Owens walked across the street from her home in Ocala, Florida, and knocked on her neighbor's door.
911, what is the address of the emergency?
I think somebody just got shot.
Owens, who is Black, was shot and killed by her neighbor, Susan Lawrence, who is white. It was a dispute that started with kids' roller skates and a misplaced iPad.
My neighbor has been screaming at the kids outside, and all of a sudden I heard what to me sounded like a gunshot. It's the old lady that always calls the cops over here.
A new documentary, The Perfect Neighbor, reconstructs the story, stitching together years of police body cam footage. Lawrence claimed she feared for her life, and initially police let her go. Geeta Gondabeer directed The Perfect Neighbor, and she joins us now. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us first about Ajika Owens. Who was she, and why did her life take such a tragic turn?
So Ajika Owens was a vibrant, vivacious young mother of four. She was a single mom. She was a cheer mom. She was a football mom. She was the mom who took extra shifts at her job to make sure that her kids could go to private school. She was a great mother, but she also had a lot of her own big dreams. She wanted to be an entrepreneur. So that's who Ajika was. And her neighbor, Susan Lawrence, was emboldened by Stand Your Ground laws that exist in 38 states in the country and took matters into her own hands over a trivial dispute around children playing in a yard next to her house where they had permission to be, and shot Ajika and killed her.
We only meet Ajika, I think, like twice in the film.
You say you already know?
That she called the police on?
Yeah, because I see you're on the phone.
What did you think of her having, like us having so little interaction with her in this story?
Sure. So Ajika Owens, just to back up a little bit, there is a personal connection for myself and my team. Ajika Owens was a family friend. And originally, we did not plan to make a film. We were assisting the family with getting media coverage for the case. And about 2 months in, we received the body camera footage from the lawyers who were working with the family, Benjamin Crump and Anthony Thomas. They did a FOIA request. And we realized that Ajika was not in the footage that much, but we felt that she was well represented through her community and through the detective interviews and through her children who you see in the film. And I think what the police inadvertently and unintentionally caught in this body camera footage is a portrait of this beautiful, tight-knit, multiracial community as they were before this terrible crime occurred. When crimes like this happen, we often only get to see the aftermath, which is the grieving family, perhaps the funeral, perhaps the trial. But in this, using the body camera footage, we were able to paint a portrait of what this place and what the people were like before the crime, and how one outlier's access to a gun and her being emboldened by Stand Your Ground laws changed everything in such a terrible way.
Tell us about that title, The Perfect Neighbor, because as you talk about, this was a real community where most of the adults were looking out for all the kids. The kids are outside playing, but there was this one outlier who was complaining, and the police said she was the only one complaining about the kids.
Yeah, so I think what we saw in that community was a strong, tight social network, people raising their children together. There's a mother who comes out and says to the police when he asks her, which one of these children is yours?
Whose mom are you?
They're all mine.
I'm saying no.
Hey. My kids aren't really here, but they're always outside playing with them.
And there's a father who comes out and says to the police, I look out for all these kids like they're my own. Susan Lawrence, as you mentioned, again, was an outsider in the sense that she moved into the community with the attitude that the community should change to fit her needs. And that is something that is reflected in her multiple calls to the police, where she again tries to weaponize the police against the community. She tries to weaponize her own privilege and also victimhood.
And Lawrence was using racial slurs against the children. She was using the N-word. So she was engaging in racist behavior, using racial slurs.
Correct. And that was well documented. And she, again, she admitted it to the police.
Yes. Well, talk to me about the Stand Your Ground laws, because I know you've mentioned them. And at the end of the film, you have some information about Stand Your Ground laws, like the one in Florida. What do you want viewers to know about these laws?
Sure. So Stand Your Ground laws have been studied, and they exist in, I believe, 38 states. Basically, the law says that if you believe your life is in imminent danger, you can defend yourself without the duty of having to retreat. This law emboldens people, and particularly we see success in people using it to claim self-defense when they are white and the person who they quote-unquote defend themselves from is not.
Or have you ever heard of the term stand your ground?
Yes.
Have you ever done any kind of research on that?
Yes, when it was mentioned on some guy shot someone at a convenience store and they said stand your ground, that was.
Susan, I think you know the reason why I'm asking that question. You're smart, okay? And the reason is...
Oh, hell no. No. Absolutely. I know what you're thinking. Did I look up the laws so I could do something? No, absolutely
you, this
not.
Is not a situation where you set something up to because you were tired of this person, you were tired of this
the rate of homicide has increased about 11% because of this law being used. And another interesting point is that self-defense laws have always existed in this country, meaning that if you feel your life is in imminent danger, you can claim self-defense in a court. You don't need this additional layer of a predatory law to do so.
One of the hardest parts for me to watch was just seeing the effect of everything on Ajika Owens's kids. You know, I have my kids and they're very loud and they're screaming and running around all the time in our backyard, and hearing them feel guilt about what happened, that maybe it was their fault. It's as a mother, you know that she would never feel that way. Mm-hmm. Do you know how they're doing now?
I just want to first address what you said about being a mother, and all of us who made the film, we are all parents. And that footage of the children hearing that they have lost their mother is incredibly painful. We know that we are asking the audience to bear witness to something that is very uncomfortable to watch. And I think the thing that people are most disturbed by is not necessarily the violence in the film, because we don't actually see the shooting, but what we see is the aftermath, and we see the grief. And grief is so hard to bear. But that grief is the true aftermath of gun violence. And the children, again, they still get up every day and they go to school and they have to carry on with their lives with this giant hole in their world, which is the loss of their mother. They are incredibly resilient, but it's a struggle. So they are living with and working through the trauma, and it is an up and down process.
That was Geeta Gondabir, director of the new documentary, The Perfect Neighbor. It's out now on Netflix. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Op-Brain Translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you're interested in connecting with KAXE listeners, call 218-326-1234 to learn about sponsorship opportunities. Big thanks to all our current business supporters. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you are a caregiver of someone with this disease, the Alzheimer's Foundation of America has a helpline to provide support, answer questions, and connect you with resources. Find more info at ALZFDN.org.